Hello and welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal newspaper. This is the Wednesday, June 22nd edition, and I'm your reader, Kevin Boucher. Headline for this first article, woman formally charged with murder for Sioux City shooting death. And this article was written by reporter Nick Hytrek, Sioux City. Prosecutors have filed a formal murder charge against a woman arrested for shooting a man in an apartment building near downtown Sioux City. Woodbury County Attorney Patrick Jennings on Friday filed a trial information charging Katrina Barnes, 32, of Sioux City, with second-degree murder, possession with intent to deliver a controlled substance, and possession of a controlled substance. Her arraignment was scheduled for June 27th in Woodbury County District Court. Second-degree murder is a Class B felony that carries a 50-year prison sentence. Police responded to the shooting on the evening of June 9th at 516 9th Street, where Barnes told them that her boyfriend, DeLorean Wade, had been shot outside her apartment door. According to court documents, Barnes told police that Wade rang the doorbell and yelled to her that he had been shot. Barnes told police Wade had not been inside, but officers observed blood throughout the apartment and found a spent shell casing inside the front door and three live rounds in the apartment. The apartment door had a bullet hole at about shoulder height. Jordan Easton, who had been inside the apartment with Barnes, told officers that Wade and Barnes had been fighting and arguing all day, and Barnes later obtained a handgun from another person, according to court documents. When Wade returned to the apartment that evening, he began banging at the door. Barnes walked to the door and fired a single shot through it, striking Wade, who died a short time later, at Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center. During the investigation, police also found 18 pills of a type consistently laced with fentanyl in a purse in Barnes' bedroom. Officers also found 17 grams of marijuana. According to court documents, Easton, who was present during the shooting, saw Wade bleeding and called 911 twice, but immediately hung up. She then called an unidentified male, who came to the apartment and took the gun used in the shooting. About 12 minutes after the shooting, Barnes called 911 to report it. Easton, 25, of Sioux City, has been charged with accessory after the fact, which is a misdemeanor. Headline, pathologist says toddler's fatal injuries are possibly caused by CPR, and this news article was written by reporter Nick Hytrek. Doctors who examined Maylin Myers and the medical examiner who performed her autopsy were too quick to determine the toddler's injuries were the result of abusive events. That's what an independent pathologist testified last Thursday. Statements that Tavon Davis made to investigators and doctors can explain the little girl's injuries were accidental, Dr. Thomas Young said. You can't jump to conclusions that this is obvious trauma. What he, Davis, said is consistent with the outcome. And that's a quote from Young. He is a private forensic pathologist from Kansas City, Missouri, and he testified in Davis's defense. Davis, 26, of Sioux City, is charged in Woodbury County District Court with first-degree murder, child endangerment resulting in the death of a child, and multiple acts of child endangerment. Prosecutors believe that he injured Mayla numerous times in the days leading up to August 22, 2018, when Davis and Malin's grandmother rushed the unresponsive toddler to a Sioux City emergency room. She was transferred to Children's Hospital in Omaha, where she never regained consciousness and died 3 days later. An Iowa State medical examiner testifying for the prosecution previously detailed the 19-month-old injuries, which include bleeding throughout the brain, a left kidney dying because the blood vessel leading to it had been torn, hemorrhaging in her eyes and the girl's abdomen. X-rays also showed healing fractures of the tibias of both legs and two vertebrae. All had fresh fractures in the healing bone material, and at least three ribs were fractured. Maylett also had bruises on her forehead and the small of her back. Maylett's death was ruled a homicide caused by complications from blunt force injuries. And Davis told investigators that he dropped Maylett after giving her a bath on August 22nd and she stopped breathing. His attempts at CPR were unsuccessful, but she was revived in the emergency room. The medical examiner and doctors testified the girl's injuries were too severe to be caused by being dropped, and CPR also was an unlikely cause. Young contradicted many of their findings, saying they failed to take into account Davis's explanations and other medical causes. If no one witnessed Maylett being intentionally hurt, Young said, her injuries can't be classified as abusive. Young said evidence of pneumonia in Maylett could explain also why she stopped breathing, or there just could be no explanation. This was a very sick child, Young said, in reference to her many trips to the doctor in the weeks before her death and her recent bouts with infections in hand, foot, and mouth disease. And during her cross-examination of Young, who said he was being paid $450 an hour by the defense, Assistant Woodbury County Attorney Christine Timmons challenged his assertion that all of Maylett's injuries could be explained by Davis's CPR attempts. And she read a transcript from Davis's police interview in which he told them he did a couple of chest compressions. Would a couple of CPR compressions in the car on Maylett Myers have caused her injuries? Timmons asked. Young said he didn't know the context of Davis's statements to police, so he couldn't say. But it did not make sense to him that Davis would only have done two compressions when Maylett was facing death. Myers said under cross-examination that she also would have been alone with Maylett for several hours each night while Davis was at work. While you were dating Tavon, Maylett never seemed afraid of Tavon. Is that correct? Public defender Jennifer Solberg asked Myers. That's correct, Myers said. Both the state and the defense rested their cases on Thursday, and Davis did not testify. The trial resumed this past Monday when the case may be submitted to the jury. If found of first-degree murder, Davis would face a mandatory sentence of life in prison without parole. And the headline for this next article, Moline Youth Drag Show Canceled After Threats. And this article was written by newspaper reporter Anthony Watt. Clock Incorporated has canceled a youth drag show which was planned for Saturday out of safety concerns. A nonprofit based in Rock Island, Clock was founded to provide a community center and services for the LGBTQ+ community. The Youth Drag Workshop was a planned part of the larger Pride Party scheduled at Bass Street Landing in Moline, one of a number of ongoing Quad Cities events that are a part of the area's celebration of Pride Month. Chase Norris, Clock's executive director, said recently that Clock made the decision because there had been negativity and threats against the venue, and Clock wanted to keep its youth safe. He declined to provide more detail, but said the Pride Party was still happening as planned. Clock announced the cancellation of the event on its Facebook page. The safety of all involved is of the utmost importance, and with the current politicized climate and some threatening emails received at the venue, and also to all organizations involved, we feel it is in everyone's best interest to cancel, the post states. The Pride Party is an annual event sponsored by the Project of the Quad Cities. Tyler Mitchell, a spokesman for the project, said it was his understanding that there were threats of protest, but not of violence. But he added he was unaware of any direct threats against the project. The project was saddened and disappointed that Clock, very focused on keeping its people safe, had to cancel the event, Mitchell said. Even if it were just protest, the emotional safety of the young people who would have participated in the show is also important, Mitchell said. Security was already planned as a part of the event. The slot for the youth show will be filled with drag shows featuring adults, Mitchell said. One Human Family QCA Incorporated issued a news release recently supporting Clock's decision to cancel the show, putting the safety of its youth first. It also condemned the threats the organizations received. The project, in a Facebook post and on One Human Family site, also stated that the Unity Pride Parade, which precedes the Pride Party on Saturday, was also canceled. Headline for this next article, Lincoln tattoo artist threw used needles at his former boss upon firing, police say. This was written by Andrew Wegley of the Lincoln Journal Star newspaper. A former employee of a Lincoln tattoo shop is in jail after he threw a handful of used needles at his boss's face and then later threatened his boss with a hatchet upon his firing. That's according to police and court records. Nicholas Yeager, 42, was arrested on Wednesday on suspicion of terroristic threats and misdemeanor criminal mischief for his alleged role in the incident, which played out at a Central Lincoln tattoo parlor on June the 4th. That's according to the affidavit for his arrest. Yeager's former boss, a 25-year-old man, told police that he terminated the 42-year-old after about 3 months of employment due to Yeager, quote, constantly causing issues and threatening him and other employees, Lincoln police said in the affidavit. When the 25-year-old did fire Yeager, Yeager became irate, according to the affidavit, throwing needles at his boss's faces and spilling tattoo ink throughout the business before moving outside. Once there, the 25-year-old man told police that Yeager chugged a glass bottle of Mike's Hard Lemonade before swinging the bottle at his boss, according to the affidavit. Yeager eventually retrieved a hatchet from his backpack and threatened to harm his boss, the police said. A witness who had been at the tattoo parlor near 27th and S Streets corroborated the 25-year-old's account of the events. Lancaster County Sheriff's deputies arrested Yeager and Hickman at around 10 p.m. that night. He is currently being held at the Lancaster County Jail on a $10,000 percentage bond. He must pay $1,000 to be released. And the headline for this next article, over 160 absentee ballot requests in Northwest Iowa for the June primary arrived late. And this story was written by reporter Jared McNett. In the run-up to the June 7th primaries in Iowa, at least 162 voters in Northwest Iowa saw their absentee ballot requests denied because they arrived in county offices too late. According to area county auditors, many of the applications would have likely been approved prior to 2021. Because in March of 2021, Governor Kim Reynolds signed a bill that requires voters to request absentee ballots from the auditor's office at least 15 days before an election. Previously, that deadline was 10 days. Sioux County Auditor Ryan Doctor said at least 45 of the 49 late absentee ballot requests that his office received would have been mailed in time under the previous law. And it's worth noting that the law requires us to notify the voters if their absentee ballot request was received late. If we received it between 14 and 17 days of the election, Doctor said via email, my office has a standard practice of notifying voters throughout the Friday before the election, so at least they are aware of their options if they would like to vote. The options include casting ballots instead on Election Day. And Doctor warned the November general election will require more staffing to address a higher number of ballot requests in a shorter window than in previous years. Now such ballots can't be mailed to voters until 20 days before the election, which is down by 9 days, and he isn't alone in that assessment. He says, I have more concerns about the general election with the snowbirds, Osceola County Auditor Rachel Van Tilburg said, and I'm concerned they won't get it in time to vote and get back to my office by Election Day. By Van Tilburg's account, 4 ballot requests for the primary election came in late to her office, and as a result, they had to be turned down. In neighboring Lyon County, Auditor Jen Smith said 16 requests came in after the 5 p.m. deadline on May 23rd. Dickinson County Elections Clerk Jordan Moyer said reporting 12 late requests. And Clay County Auditor Ann Baskey noted 11 coming in after the deadline. The only adjustment to the current law that may be beneficial would be to allow county auditors to mail out absentee ballots 5 days prior to the date in-person absentee voting begins, Gilkey said Wednesday in an email. And after, along with shortening of the window for when absentee ballots can be sent out and when they need to be received, the 2021 election law makes it so that local officials can only mail out a request if a voter asks for one. It also stipulates that early ballots must be received by Election Day, no matter when they were first mailed. And though the number of denied ballots in Siouxland represented just a sliver of the total voting block, municipal and county elections in the area have seen razor-thin margins between winning and losing candidates. In May, in Thurston County, Nebraska, for example, an initial vote total for the Republican nomination for Board of Supervisors District 7 showed challenger Jim Mueller with a 55-54 lead over Dan Trimble. And in North Sioux City in 2021, a mayoral race between Patricia Teal and Linda Kutzinger came down to drawing cards. And Woodbury County Auditor Pat Gill said the ramifications of the changes will be felt more in the fall. The impact so far is a lot less requests, and what I'm concerned about in November is I know of a lot of people expecting to get that request form, and they're not going to get it, Gill said. And the headline for this next article, new Skywalk LED lighting is brightening up downtown Sioux City. And this was written by reporter Dolly Butts. Rows of multicolored bulbs below the Skywalk's bridges are brightening up Sioux City's downtown, and the LED lighting made its debut the week of June 6 at Nebraska and Pierce Streets, and since then, 2 more Skywalk bridges have been illuminated. Between Pierce and Jones Streets, each location has 700 bulbs. Lighting seems to be something that we get a lot of positive feedback on. People are really loving them. They think they're cool. And that's a quote from Reagan Cote. Reagan is the executive director of Downtown Partners. Cote said LED lights are the second phase in a larger lighting plan for downtown. I feel that at any time you can light up a space, not only does it feel safe, but it also provides kind of a sense of activity, she said. Between lighting and music, you can do a lot with active spaces. It doesn't have to be full of people. Downtown Partners first sought to brighten dimly lit portions of the city's downtown corridors with festoon lighting in 2019 to encourage more people to readily walk in those areas. Big bulb garland lights were installed along the historic 4th Street District and then later added several blocks to the west at 4th and Pearl Streets. After Hard Rock Hotel and Casino offered to help the group purchase another set of festoon lights. And that kind of bookended what we were calling a pedestrian walkway that we wanted to lighten and brighten up so people could walk safely at night between the two entertainment districts, Coates said. And the second part of that plan is what you're seeing now with the lights underneath the skywalks. Coates said Downtown Project partners funded the $19,000 skywalk lighting project and worked with local businesses Holiday Cheer Lighting on it. And she said the lights, which are timed to turn on at dusk, can be easily and inexpensively programmed. And if the lighting holds up well over the next year, Coates said more of it could be coming to downtown Sioux City. We get to kind of decide what light goes on, what we want to see for color, and we also have some programming options for movement. It's a great opportunity if someone's holding an event downtown, she said. This is going to be fun when all three of them are up. The next phase of Downtown Partners' lighting plan will focus on Northern Downtown and Pearl Street Park, according to Coates. She said the group is working with the city on a shade structure to accompany seating elements for Food Truck Fridays. And in that park, she says, we're going to look at illuminated seating. So at night, all the benches and chairs will light up, said Coates, who expects those upgrades to be implemented by late summer. And again, the cost of the whole project for the downtown skywalk lighting is around $19,000, and the entire project should involve 2,100 bulbs, and currently, right now, there are three skywalk bridges now illuminated with lights, with more to come. And this next article, the headline says, NAACP President Speaks on Juneteenth. And this story was written by reporter Owen Ziliak, Sioux City. For Ike Rafer, Juneteenth is not just another holiday. The president of the Sioux City NAACP branch has been celebrating the day long before it was recognized as a national holiday last year. I grew up in Dallas, Texas, and Juneteenth was celebrated first in Texas, he said. It is a huge celebration there. And then fast forward to 2022, and we are happy and excited that it has been recognized by more people, states, and the whole country. Juneteenth is a combination of the words June and 19th. And Juneteenth commemorates the effective end of slavery in the United States. In June of 1865, 2.5 years after President Lincoln delivered the Emancipation Proclamation, federal troops marched into Galveston, Texas to take control of the state and to free any remaining slaves. The holiday is also known as Juneteenth Independence Day, Emancipation Day, or Freedom Day. For many Americans, Juneteenth is still a new concept. And for those that do not yet understand the date's significance, Rayford offered his interpretation. When we think of America as a whole, we think of our black citizens, many of whom had a history of slavery, he said. And it's seen as a stain on American history. And when we think of America as being the land of the free, we cannot help but celebrate the fact that all slaves were informed that they were free. Rafer compares Juneteenth to another 4th of July, for example. Our Day of Independence, that is the comparison, Rafer said. And so when we think that in relation to our country, the United States of America, we think of being independent of British rule. And this is our celebration as black Americans that we are finally free from slavery. And because this year Juneteenth fell on a Sunday, federal employees were given the day off on Monday, June 20th. Despite the weight that it holds to some community members, Sioux Cityans should not expect it to be recognized as a city holiday anytime soon. And that's according to Sioux City Mayor Bob Scott. Scott said that while Juneteenth is an important date, he would not be considering a movement to make it a holiday for city employees. Scott said that while Juneteenth is an important date, he says, "I think we have too many holidays already," he said. "And Juneteenth is certainly one that would be worthy of being added, but we just have too many." Currently, city employees have roughly 10 holidays, depending on contract negotiations. And when debating on whether to make Martin Luther King Jr. Day a holiday, city officials in 2015 said that an additional day off would cost the city around $165,000. Now, these added costs include holiday pay for essential city workers like police and firefighters. Headline for this next article, Scott Mitchell is chosen to lead Woodbury County Emergency Services, and this article was written by reporter Caitlin Yamada. Hornick Mayor Scott Mitchell has been chosen as the Woodbury County Emergency Services Director. The Board of Supervisors will be asked on Tuesday to approve Mitchell's hiring, which will be effective June 30th. Mitchell currently works as a construction technician for the Iowa Department of Transportation, and he's also on the Hornick Fire Department. He'll replace Andrew Danawa, who resigned after just 6 months as a director due to a hostile work environment that he attributed to current and former staff. Board Chair Keith Radig said that Mitchell was in the top three of the supervisors' list after a variety of job interviews, and he was who they chose to move forward with. Mitchell had been the mayor of Hornick since 2015, and he was overwhelmingly reelected in 2019 after leading the town through one of the worst floods in history. Mitchell was lauded for his leadership during the crisis, and he was one of six residents honored for acts of valor by then-Iowa 4th District Representative Steve King, and he'll start as the director at a salary of $80,000 a year, and again, he will begin working on June 30th. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal newspaper for Wednesday, June 22nd on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now let's turn to today's obituaries. And our first obituary, Linda S. Lynn Anders of Sioux City, 70, died on June 10th. She was born on February 1st. 1952, in Wahoo, Nebraska, the daughter of Robert and Marianne Peterson Garner. She graduated from the Bronson High School in 1970 and then attended Western Iowa Tech Community College in accounting and in medical studies. In 1988, Lynn was united in marriage to Bruce Anders. Lynn is survived by her son, Corey Jenkins, brothers Mark Garner, Brian Garner, and Robert Garner, and she's also survived by sisters Marie Huseman and Debbie June Dreves. She was preceded in death by her parents, her husband Bruce in 2021, and Jeff Garner. Stanton Dean Stan Cully of Lamars, Iowa, 74, passed away on Sunday, June 12. Stan was born July 17, 1947, in Sioux City, to Homer and Esther Cully. Stan graduated from Central High School with the class of 1965, and he continued his education at the Valparaiso Technical Institute in Valparaiso, Indiana. Graduating in 1968 with an Engineering of Technology degree. Stan served in the United States Army from May of 1968 until his honorable discharge in February of 1970. Stan is survived by two brothers, Lynn and Barb Cully of Raleigh, North Carolina, Mark Cully of Kansas City, Missouri, nephew Chris Cully of Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and their daughters, Emerson, Olivia, and Katie Jane. Nephew Adam Cully of Raleigh and their daughters, Avery and Ashlyn, and nephew Brad Cully of Roseville, California, and their sons, Hosiah, Noah, and Elijah. Stan was preceded in death by his mother, Esther, in 2008, Father Homer in 2010, and Brother Dennis Cully in 2019. And in lieu of flowers, memorials may be offered to Hospice of Siouxland. Mildred Lucille Davis, 98 of Sioux City, departed this earth on Monday, June 13th of 2022. Mildred was the 10th child of Eugene and Emily Maddie Ollison. She spent her early years in and around Roston, Waterloo, and Willisville, Arkansas. She attended the Nevada County Training School System from elementary to her high school graduation in 1942. Mildred accepted Christ at an early age, and she became a member of the Pleasant Grove Missionary Baptist Church. After moving to Sioux City, she retained long fellowships and memberships at Mount Zion Missionary Baptist Church and Mayflower Congregational UCC. She was a real support to her husband as they navigated through post-war Sioux City in the late 1940s and early 1950s. She held various jobs from cooking at the day nursery to being a worker at the Goodwill, a poultry plant worker, a cleaning lady for Yonkers Department Store, and she also had a passion for sewing. She took tailoring classes and advanced sewing classes. She crafted dresses, skirts, blouses, and even men's suits. She was original board member of the Sioux City Soup Kitchen, and she had a passion for the less fortunate, which reminded her of the hardship she encountered growing up in rural Arkansas during the Depression. Mildred is survived by her daughter, Gwendolyn Warren, two grandsons, William, Sean, and Marcus, great-grandchildren, Todd William Warren, Jacqueline Davis, Orlando Davis, Jamal Davis, Malachi Warren, and Joshua Ortiz. She is also survived by great-grandchildren, Caden Davis, Isabella Ortiz, and Calliope Ortiz, and a host of nieces, nephews, and extended family. She was preceded in death by her parents, Eugene and Emily Ollison, siblings Belton Ollison, Vira Tidwell, Verla Beasley, Coy Ollison, Ronald Curtis Ollison, John Ollison, Gladia Davis, Christine Elliott, and Andrew Ollison, husband Cecil Davis, daughter Jacqueline Millett, and her grandson, Todd R. Warren. Lester Graz, 97, of Lamars, passed away on Wednesday, June 15th, at Floyd Valley Healthcare in Lamars. He was born October 18, 1924, in Lamars, Iowa, the son of Alfred and Hannah Graz. He grew up in a farm in Grant Township, rural Plymouth County, Iowa. He attended a country school in Brunsville, Iowa. He was united in marriage to Ruth Ludwigs on May 25, 1948, and they started on a farm near Craig before moving to a farm just east of Hidden, Iowa, in 1954. He and his wife moved to Ruth's parents' farm west of Lamars, where they farmed until retirement Lester also did custom work for area farmers. He is survived by his wife of over 74 years, Ruth of Lamars, son Randy Graz of Sioux City, daughter Carol Janicek of Lamars, three grandchildren, Joe and Alicia Graz of Lamars, Chris Trapp of Sioux City, and Stacy Graz of Alchester, South Dakota. 10 great-grandchildren, 1 great-great-grandchild, 2 brothers, Vernon Graz of Lamars and Larry Graz of Lamars, and several nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents, Alfred and Anna Graz, daughter-in-law, Sandy Graz, 2 brothers, Orville Graz and Norman Graz, and sister-in-law, Pat Graz. Linda R. Mize, 64, of Bronson, passed away on Wednesday, June 15th, after battling a lengthy illness. She was born on July 3rd, 1956, in Sioux City, Iowa. She attended Woodbury Central High School and graduated in 1974. She then attended Morningside College and graduated with a degree in education. On May 27, 1989, Linda married Greg Mize. In 1993, she began teaching at the Sioux City Community School District, where she touched so many lives. She retired in 2018. She is survived by her husband, Greg Mize, children Missy and Andre Humphrey, Candace and Joshua Clymer, Ken Peterson, and fiancé Andy Harmon, Elizabeth Betty Freeking of Lamars, Iowa, 86 years old, entered into eternal life on Wednesday, June 15th of 2022 at Good Samaritan Society in Lamars, Iowa. Betty was born July 14, 1935 in Lamars, the daughter of Henry and Gertrude Wersinger Bush. She was baptized at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Remsen, Iowa, and confirmed at Holy Name Catholic Church. She attended Holy Name High School in Marcus, Iowa. Betty worked as a telephone operator and seamstress before marrying Herman Jr. Clem Freaking Jr. on May 3, 1956, at Holy Name Catholic Church in Marcus. Betty will be lovingly remembered for her devotion to her family and faith. She is survived by her children, Mary Kay, and her husband, Rick Jewell of Lamars, Diane and her husband, Rick Bach of Lamars, Iowa, Christy and her husband, Todd Siders of Castle Rock, Colorado, Dale Freaking and his wife, Lise of Eagan, Minnesota, Jeffrey Freeking of Sioux City, Dean Freeking and his wife Julia of Milton, Massachusetts, Gerald Freeking and his wife Rebecca of Fort Washington, Maryland, and Charles Freeking and his wife Michelle of Sergeant Bluff, Iowa, Douglas Freeking and his wife Jennifer of Cummings, Iowa, and Angela and her husband Dennis Meister of Tulsa, Oklahoma. She is also survived by daughter-in-law Michaela Freeking of August, Kansas, son-in-law Don Buma of Lamars, 39 grandchildren, 42 great-grandchildren, 12 brothers and sisters, Clara Barnett, Henry Bud Bush, Helen Curtis, Agnes Cox, Raymond Bush, Mary Beasley, Joe Bush, Joyce Merrill, Joanne Jennis, Paul Bush, Lawrence Bush, and Louise Rodriguez, brother-in-law Harold Freiking and his wife Kay, and sister-in-law Karen McPherson and her husband Rick. Betty was preceded in death by her husband, Junior, son Stephen Herman, daughter Linda Ann Buma, and daughter-in-law, Mary Schrader Fry King, grandson Brody Fry King, great-granddaughter Daisy Pippet, brother Johnny Bush, and sister Gertrude Trudy Peterson. Robert J. Bob O'Donnell of Sioux City, 90 years old, passed away on Tuesday, June the 14th, 2022, at a local care center. He was born September 17, 1931, in Centerville, South Dakota, the son of William P. and Lula Barnett O'Donnell. The family moved to Sioux City when he was 10 years old. He attended Immaculate Conception School and graduated from Trinity High School in 1949. Bob married Joanne Dunn on April 11, 1953, in Salix, Iowa. They had one daughter and two sons. Bob was a master upholsterer and worked with several furniture stores in Sioux City. He continued to reupholster furniture until he was 86 years old. In 1966, Bob was employed by the Terica Chemical Company until he retired in 1996. Bob enjoyed playing cards with family and friends. He also loved fishing, hunting, berry picking for blackberries, traveling, and spending time with his family. Bob is survived by his children, Pam and Jim Brown of Bemidji, Minnesota, Richard and Tammy O'Donnell of Bellevue, Nebraska, and Ronald and Karen O'Donnell of Sergeant Bluff. Grandchildren, Aaron and Paul Olerick of Savage, Minnesota, Michael and Kelsey O'Donnell of Omaha, Nebraska, Alicia, E.J. O'Donnell Lines of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, Kelsey, Young Hung Lai O'Donnell of Taiwan, and Megan and Graham Brunning O'Donnell of Coralville, Iowa. He is also survived by seven great-grandchildren, Kennedy, Liliana, Madeline, Aiden, Grayson, Elowen, and Sophia. And he was preceded in death by his parents, wife Joanne, of 54 years, grandson Ryan O'Donnell, and siblings Richard, William, Eileen, and Mary Lou. And now turning to the opinion page of the Wednesday, June 22nd Sioux City Journal newspaper. And this is from the editorial staff of the newspaper. Headline, our opinion, East High School student rep is right to call out school board behavior. Congratulations, Dominic Eastman. You have been able to do what members of the Sioux City School Board apparently haven't. At Monday's board meeting, Eastman, an East High School Student Council representative to the board who has attended meetings throughout the year, addressed the board and its recent behavior, specifically the way board president Dan Greenwell has been treating other board members. Eastman called Greenwell's actions a form of bullying and said he was unfit to be the board's president. Scarlett's response? You have never respected a board member up here. Eastman said the clash was all too familiar. As a student, he was bullied. When I did speak out, I was told I was looking for attention and literally told to stop looking for my 15 minutes of fame. The recently East graduate called for a change in leadership. And now from the opinion page, here's a letter to the editor written by John Coates of Sioux City, Iowa. And he says, oil companies are price gouging by bidding on crude oil. The oil companies get to bid on crude oil. Isn't this a racket or what? Hello? The bidding war doesn't have anything to do with the refining cost. The price gouging just keeps going on, and our politicians have blinders on. We are making electric cars and trucks, etc. This will help save on crude oil, plus windmills, plus solar power. And so maybe this is why the oil companies want more profits, huh? The oil company's oil inflation is a plain crime. So it is time to call right our politicians. It's time to do what they were voted for, right? This is my opinion. John Coates, Sioux City, Iowa. And let's see, let's read one more letter to the editor from the Sioux City newspaper. Headline, National News Organizations Threaten Democracy. Vladimir Putin's absolute control of the Russian national news narrative within his country is appalling. And I also find appalling that our American national news organizations, other than Fox News, overwhelmingly protect and support Democrats in their political aspirations, while at the same time they consistently denigrate Republicans in their political aspirations. Just be objective and call balls and strikes the same for both of our major political parties. This country has no chance of coming together with the bias flowing from the corporate boardrooms and editorial staffs of these national news organizations, TV, print, and social media. And these corporate boardrooms and editorial staffs are one of the greatest threats to our democracy. And that was a letter to the editor, and it was written and submitted by Bill Young of Lamars, Iowa. And turning back to news, headline for this article. Sioux City City Council okays hot car ordinance. Pets cannot be kept in a parked car in hot weather without AC. The Sioux City Council unanimously voted Monday to adopt an ordinance that prohibits individuals from keeping animals in a vehicle or the bed of a parked truck when the outdoor temperature exceeds 79 degrees Fahrenheit, unless the animal is enclosed inside the vehicle with the air conditioning turned on. Previously, the city code had a non-specific requirement that animals not be kept in vehicles during conditions of temperature extremes. This new ordinance is adapted from a similar code in Stillwater, Oklahoma, that often experiences higher summer temperatures. In 30 minutes, it can heat up to 114 degrees. It gets hot real quick, he says. And under this new ordinance in Sioux City, as well as previous language in the code, a peace officer or animal control officer is authorized to use whatever force is reasonable and necessary to remove any animal from a vehicle or other enclosed space whenever it appears that the animal's life or health is endangered by extreme temperatures or lack of ventilation. The officers would not be liable for any damage caused to the vehicle or other enclosed space. I'm somewhat supportive, but it's amazing to me. We have a dog ordinance now, but we don't have a kid ordinance. It's totally unbelievable, Mayor Bob Scott said. I'm not anti-dog or anti-pets, but kids are a heck of a lot more important to me than a dog or a cat. Mayor Pro Tem Dan Moore asked if animals tend to survive being left in hot cars, and Wall said animal control officers have responded to a few calls this year, but he said by the time officers arrived on the scene, the vehicles had already left. We've not actually caught anybody this year, Wall said. But as we were leaving this afternoon, there is a dead dog case that's come in from a dog that was left outside, not in a vehicle, but it was left outside all afternoon. Anyone found in violation of this proposed ordinance would receive a municipal infraction penalty. First offense would be $100 plus cost for a total of $195 in fines. Headline for this next article, 5 people to be interviewed for Iowa High Court spot. Five applicants, including a Sioux City judge, will be interviewed for an opening on the Iowa Supreme Court. That will occur when Justice Brent Apple retires next month, the court announced in a news release on Monday. When Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds appoints the new justice, it will be her fifth appointment to the seven-member Iowa Supreme Court. All five candidates will be interviewed on Monday, June 27, by the state's Judicial Nomination Commission. Now, this is a 17-member commission, and they will select three finalists, after which Reynolds will have 30 days to select one of the finalists as the next justice. And when she makes this next selection, Reynolds will have appointed five Iowa Supreme Court justices during her 6 years in office. Appel is the court's last remaining member who was appointed by a Democratic governor, Tom Vilsack, in 2006. And Appel was retained by the voters in the 2016 judicial retention elections. This summer, Appel will turn 72, and that's the age at which Iowa judges are required by law to retire. And the five candidates scheduled to be interviewed next Monday are Patrick Tott, the 3rd District's chief judge from Sioux City. Tott has also interviewed for an Iowa Supreme Court opening in the past, and he was one of the two Iowa judges who ruled in a 2020 lawsuit that Iowa County elections officials made mistakes in mailing out absentee ballot request forms with personal information filled in. Tott was appointed to the district court bench in September of 2014 by then-Governor Terry Branstad. Timothy Garten, he is a lawyer with Hastings, Garten, and Bottinger in Ames. Garten served on the Ames City Council and in 2010 ran for the Iowa Senate as a Republican. Alan Heavens, a 1st District judge from Garnavalo. Heavens is a former Clayton County attorney. And David May, an Iowa Court of Appeals judge from Polk County, Iowa. And the last candidate to be interviewed on June 27, William Miller, a lawyer with Dorsey and Whitney in Des Moines. Miller, who specializes in business law, has interviewed for a previous Iowa Supreme Court vacancy. Well, that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal newspaper for Wednesday, June the 22nd. Hi, I'm your reader, Kevin Boucher. And remember, you can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.